Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is once again your navigator, John Lash, recording now in the early hours of the morning of February 9th, 2014. This is Nav Briefing number 109. Let's call it The Countermanding Truth. Now, obviously, this briefing is a close follow-up to the previous one entitled Defeating Duplicity. And it picks up immediately with the Matangi strategy that I outlined at the end of that previous talk. It stopped raining now, and it's calm and rather warm, actually, here in the middle of the night in Spain. I'm staying up late, well, I often do, whether the skies are clear or not, whether or not I'm observing from my terrace. But this evening I'm up late because I have to go to the airport early to pick up my best friend, so I'm quite happy that I'm having a visit from my best friend, whom I haven't seen for almost 8 months now. And that's the longest time that I haven't seen her since I met her back in 1995. So I'm really happy about that, and I'll see if I can stick it out here this morning until it's time for me to drive to the airport in Malaga. Speaking of friends and loved ones and people who love me or you, and those whom we love, I could perhaps say a little bit about the subject of unconditional love, which I had intended as the topic for Nav Briefing number 108. Well, I just want to say this as a glimpse toward a glimpse or a preview toward that briefing when it comes up soon. In my experience, it's helpful to distinguish between two forms of unconditional love. One of them is just simple unconditional love, the simple case, let's say. All human animals are capable of unconditional love for other human animals and even for other animals that are not human. But let's say we're talking now about interhuman affairs, okay? Well, the simple case of unconditional love is a wonderful thing, and you're lucky if you enjoy it. I happen to enjoy it in three instances, specific to people who are in my physical environment. So, in the actual world where I live, I only have contact with three human animals who feel unconditional love for me. And that form of unconditional love they have for me is simple, or what I would call, it's uninformed. By contrast, the love that I feel for those three animals is what might be called informed unconditional love. Now, it's the same love, but in one case, in the second case, it's informed. Well, what does that mean? It means that the unconditional love that I feel toward them is inseparable from certain realizations of the ultimate nature of consciousness which I happen to have had in the course of my mystical life. And so the unconditional love I feel is informed by something cosmic, by a cosmic or mystical perspective. By contrast, the unconditional love that they feel toward me is not so informed. Why not? Simply because they haven't had those experiences, and certainly not to the extent or scope that applies to my case. So it's really remarkable to reflect that these two forms of unconditional love could exist, yet the unconditional love is identical in both forms. So these three people who love me unconditionally, who are the only three people on the planet who love me unconditionally, by the way, who are in contact with me physically and directly, have the same privilege and power of unconditional love, if you want to call it a power, that I enjoy, although mine is derived from certain sublime and mystical experiences, which anyone can have, but not everyone does have. So I am certain that any one of these three individuals would happily and readily tell you that they have not had experiences of, quote, cosmic consciousness or cosmic mystical awakening of the heart lotus comparable to those that I've had, because I happen to be disposed toward those experiences, very powerfully disposed, for one reason or another. It is standard in the life experience of a mystic to have experiences such as these. So all the many mystics you can name, whether it would be A.E., which was George Russell, the Irish mystic who wrote The Candle of Vision, whether it be Yogananda, Rajneesh, Walt Whitman, other cases of known people listed in the book Cosmic Consciousness by Maurice Buck, which was published in 1899, and so forth and so on. So it just so happens that some human animals happen to have these powerful mystical awakenings. And when that happens, then the realizations so attained, if you can talk about attainment, inform the capacity for unconditional love. But in its simple and natural essence, the unconditional love in both cases is exactly the same. Those people who love me didn't come to their unconditional love in the way that I did, in the way that I came to my love for them, but they came through it more by a trial and error process. And they had two ingredients that are necessary for everyone to reach unconditional love. First is the desire to want that love, to want to know that love, the heartfelt desire to want to love unconditionally. You have to want it to get it, and you have to want it badly, very, very badly. And secondly, the ingredient, which is a key factor, it's a chemistry between these two ingredients. Neither one alone will do it. Well, that would be the disposition to learn how to handle it. Because even if you want to reach unconditional love, even with just one other human animal more than anything else in the world, and you don't have the disposition to learn how to handle it, you won't succeed. And so these three characters have succeeded in reaching unconditional love for yours truly. And those are the only three people on this planet that I know face to face who have that love for me. There are some others, I must add, certainly I must add, a few others who have met me physically and also have unconditional love for me. But I am not generally in physical contact with those other people, those other individuals, and I only see them rarely and occasionally. So that's a difference to be noted. And having stated that difference, I want you all to know that you are happily included, and those who hear me and know that I'm talking to them will certainly know that my gratitude is boundless. And if you know what unconditional love is, then you also know the gratitude that comes with it. The gratitude not just of being loved in that way, but the gratitude toward being able to love in that way. To feel grateful to be able to love in that way comes in the package of unconditional love. So those are just some remarks floating through the room this evening as I stand here. And why do I bring up that little preview on the topic of unconditional love at this particular moment? Well, hold on. Hold on just a second. I'm going to pause now. Okay, as I'm pausing, the wind is whistling around the house outside, a kind of low, modulating whistle. And I'm considering how the subject of love, unconditional love, configures in my mind with the resonance of other things, the resonance of other themes, in particular the theme of defeating duplicity by striking back at it with a countermanding truth. Now love, unconditional love, as far as I know, has an application toward oneself as well as toward others. I mean, it may be obvious to you that I say that, but it's not necessarily as obvious as it looks, perhaps. I don't pretend to be speaking from some lofty mountaintop about unconditional love. On the contrary, I'm just standing here in my Minnetonka moccasins in this little room, all by my lonesome, just telling you what I have discovered. And I may be in error, so I can't make any ultimate authoritative pronouncements. But I can tell you with the greatest conviction that I have exactly what I did realize at those moments when I underwent some kind of awesome cosmic heart awakening into the nature of unconditional love, which is the foundation of everything that exists, as far as I can tell. I'm standing here in this room, you're listening to me, because unconditional love allows us to do so. It brought us into the freedom of this experience. It brought us to the opportunity to be human. And everything is brought to the opportunity to be what it is by the unconditional love at the root of the universe itself, as far as I can tell. That is my informed view. Well, in those moments when this experience dawns upon you, and it is a rush, of the awakening of the chalice of the heart lotus and its abounding beauty that overflows, constantly overflows its source. And it's in that rush, I found that certain things came to be defined with crystal clarity in my mind. Cognitive ecstasy is exactly what it says. So, the one thing that I would share in this context concerns that application I just noted. The application toward others and the application toward yourself. You know, crudely speaking, I mean, you can say that unconditional love is a capacity. I'm not sure if I was correct in saying it's a capacity that belongs to every human animal. That's a difficult question, but I'll leave that aside for the moment. Let's just say that it is in the range of the endowment of the human animal to be capable of unconditional love. And then when you realize it, you realize that it has an application toward others and an application toward yourself. And for me, one of the outstanding, awesome, stunning truths to come from my experiences, my moments, because they're only moments. They're moments that never pass, but they're still just moments. One of the paramount realizations that came to me was that when you acquire by the mystical approach, by the mystical experience, when you acquire the capacity for unconditional love, it is given to you unconditionally. That is to say, it comes with no obligation whatsoever to express it toward anyone except yourself. You may have wondered what it would be like to be overwhelmed and awesomely flooded with the power of unconditional love. And I'm sure I'm talking to any number of people who have had that experience. And you can say with it, you can say of it, what you will. I would love to hear what you have to say about it. But this is what I have to say. Never once did I come away from that experience feeling compelled to pour out that unconditional love to anyone else. Never. And I realized that if I did express it toward anyone else, it would be a free action on my part. That flood, that awesome surge in the heart center, which opens so far that it empties itself into an emptiness that never has to close upon anything again. In that emptiness of the broke open heart of unconditional non-separation, there is absolutely no compulsion to show it or express it to anyone else. At least such is my testimony. Now, you might think that someone who has this moment of realization of unconditional love gets up from their knees and their face is streaming with tears. Well, I've been on my knees with my face streaming with tears and sobbing myself into a total human sponge. But still, I did not feel compelled to rush to any other human being and pour out this quality of love to that other individual. No. The only obligation that comes with unconditional love, which is given to you unconditionally from the source of love, is that you must apply it to yourself. That you must do. That is the one condition of unconditional love. And then, depending on your disposition, and depending on a great many things, you can go forward in life, and you can go into the world and into your interactions with other people, and you can, in one way or another, demonstrate and express and manifest and impart the unconditional love that you feel. But I must say, speaking as a Kalika, that Rajneesh was absolutely right when he said that love is no longer authentic in the human animal, and that the authenticity of love and the very genuine and legitimate experience of unconditional love has itself been spoiled and ruined by the teaching about love. So, for instance, you have probably been taught, you have certainly been taught, as I have, that if you meet a human being who has achieved unconditional love, then they are going to, that individual is going to act toward you in a way that obviously manifests their capacity for unconditional love. And that is not true. That is simply not true. That is one of the areas where Rajneesh's warning applies with special pertinence, I believe. If you expect someone who has achieved unconditional love to behave toward you in a way that you consider as the obvious and verifiable proof that they have it, you're going to be very disappointed and confused. Because someone who has realized unconditional love does not necessarily act like what you would call or consider to be a loving person. Or even if they do, you might not recognize the skill and finesse of that loving person, because what you have been taught about love disposes you to expect something different. And of course, you know what I'm talking about here. When you take, you know, Jesus Christ, the magical friend of the human species, the imaginary friend of the human species, like a child has an imaginary friend, right? Little Frank the rabbit, or, you know, like Mary the little mole, or some imp, or some smurf. And so, what is Jesus Christ but the imaginary friend of the human species who has systematically betrayed humanity? And one of the horrific deceits in the teaching of love, which has damaged our capacity not only to love but to recognize it when it's in front of you, is this assumed portrait of Jesus standing there with the love pouring from his eyes, the beautiful soft eyes, and that radiant loving gaze like amber just melting and pouring over you, and the ultimate instrument of divine love on the earth looking at you with a look of love. And of course, you would have to have Barry White singing in the background. And then you'd have the perfect image of a loving person, wouldn't you? And it's just not that way. love and freedom go together. It comes with the unconditional freedom to do anything with it that you like, to give it to anyone that you like or not, but with the single and exceptional condition that you express it toward yourself. And that's where the subject of love, unconditional love, links intimately to the concluding theme of the previous talk. The countermanding truth that you use to strike against duplicity in this world has to be supported by love. And it's the love for yourself that gives that truth its invincible quality. You love the truth as much as you love your life. You love the truth of your life as much as you love your life itself. That's some syntax for self-love. If you consider the applications and expressions and behavioral manifestations, if you will, of unconditional love, person to person, then you must always consider that love and freedom go together. Don't talk to me about love, and don't give me no love, unless it's free. I don't want your love unless it's free, and unless it frees you to give it to me. Freedom and love go together in the interpersonal dynamic of love, but in the intrapersonal, the relation of you to yourself, the dynamic, the intimate synergy operates on the complementarity of love and truth. And I think I could say, and I've never said this before, but I think I could say that genuine self-love coming from unconditional love, which is the source of life, is inseparable from the sense of truth. The sense of truth is a sense in the human animal. It's a sense like the sense of smell, the sense of touch, the sense of shame, the sense of balance, the sense of proportion, the sense of truth, or the sense for truth, is indelibly bonded to the self-love you feel toward your own simple and mortal animal existence. And so, for each of us now, the challenge of the Matangi strategy, the highest Matangi strategy, is to find the countermanding truth to strike against duplicity in whatever particular form it manifests. There are many and diverse forms of duplicity. You encounter duplicity as a real fact in the world. It is a real fact of behavior. It is a real fact of communication. It is spoken. It is written. It is manifested in actions, in agendas, in philosophies, in political and social programs such as communism, socialism, democracy. Duplicity comes forward to meet you in concrete ways. And for you to strike back at the duplicity with the countermanding truth, you need the discernment to see which truth applies to which particular duplicity you're facing. That factor of discernment is crucial. You need that discernment but more essentially, the foundation of your efficacy to defeat duplicity is in your love for the truth of your life and the truth upon which you stand and the truth that lives through you and that will outlive you. Self-love in the human animal engenders the sense for truth. And once that sense is ignited, it can never be extinguished. Even when you die, the truth which you are living now outlives you and comes to be received and absorbed by other people. And this was understood in the pagan world very deeply. And the time has come for it to be understood again in the Gaian society of correction. I learned many, many years ago, probably when I was maybe 19, and I was in Tokyo, reading the Golden Bough. I used to go to the British Council, which is kind of like a UK public relations center in different capitals of the world, in different foreign capitals. You could go to the British Council. And they had a library, and there were books in English. This was somewhere in Tokyo. And they had the entire 16 volumes or whatever, 14 volumes of the Golden Bough, and like in a beautiful light green binding. The Golden Bough by Sir James Fraser. And I think that's where I began to read about heroic lore in the pagan world, in the pre-Christian world. And what I came to discover at that time developed for many years in my mind before I summarized it in my book on the hero. In the ancient pagan world, heroes were men of exceptional prowess and power and courage. And they were warriors, but they were also men of ethics. Men of honor who represented moral and civic ideals to the population at large. So the heroic male was a model, the heroic female as well. That's another subject. But it was understood of heroes generally that they had a surfeit of life force above and beyond that of the ordinary person. And shrines, numerous shrines to particular heroes, such as Aeneas, the hero of the Trojan War, or Heracles, or many heroes whose names have been forgotten. Shrines dedicated to these heroes were constructed throughout the pagan world. When people went to these shrines and sat there in meditation, in reverence and gratitude toward the hero, they absorbed, as it were, some of the mana or spiritual power of that departed hero. It was understood that when the hero dies, a part of his or her life essence, which is in excess of mortal existence, continues to live on, which is not the case with non-heroic people. And in the pagan world, it was considered perfectly normal and legitimate to make this distinction. Not everyone could claim the status of a hero because you had to prove that you were a hero by doing heroic deeds and by exhibiting prowess. And as I said in my book on the hero, you know a hero, you define him and measure him by what he stands up against. And the characteristic of the hero is to take on overwhelming forces. The hero never rarely takes on his equal, but rather takes on overwhelming and monstrous forces. This is the mythological motif that you find in books such as discussed vastly and in countless examples in books such as The Golden Bough by Sir James Fraser or
The Hero by Lord Raglan. Well, the same applies now to the generic, let's say, the generic force of the human animal in correction. Everyone who lives in correction now reaches the level of exceptionality that was only granted to the hero in former times. You see? And that surfeit of life force is a kind of, what shall I call it? It's a kind of secondary product of unconditional self-love. But unconditional self-love is incomplete if it is not linked to some immortal truth that you are living, the immortal truth to which your mortal life is dedicated. You see? Because unconditional self-love also needs the factor of truth. That's the intrapersonal dynamic, remember? And in the extra or interpersonal dynamic, it's the coupling of love and freedom. So the coupling of love and truth is what I'm talking about here. This is the meditation to undertake to prepare yourself for the ultimate Kalika strategy. Matangi's strike. Matangi's offense against the trickster. It has to be offensive. Unfortunately, so many of the people today who are exposing the fraud and duplicity in the world, in all the various areas that I've mentioned in the last talk, which are too tedious to mention again, media, medicine, blah, blah, blah. Unfortunately, the people exposing all that as sincere and dedicated as they may be, if they are indeed sincere and dedicated, are mired in the problem. You see, they're mired in the problem because they're not coming up behind the exposure of duplicity with the offensive blow upon duplicity that defeats it. To do that, they must bring out of themselves and out of the very substance of their own lives the truth they are willing to die for and will die for. And you may as well die for something because you are going to die. That's a certainty. So the mortal human animal needs self-love and needs to couple it with that sense for truth. And I'm convinced that when you find this quality of self-love in yourself and foster it, and acknowledge it and own it and realize how good and right and true and correct it is and distinguish it from narcissism, which is the obsessive self-concern of people who are incapable of loving themselves. When you can do all that, you ignite a flame in you. You ignite a flame. The coupling of love and truth ignites a flame that cannot be extinguished. It ignites an invincible force. And this is the force we take into the jaws of duplicity. This is the force of engagement.
Now, I just want to say, in a kind of summary, now that I'm saying this, which I had not expected to say, that there must be a reciprocity. I don't mean there must be in the sense that there has to be. I mean that there necessarily is a reciprocity between the self-love
in you and your beholding of the natural world and the planet upon which you live. There is a reciprocity. If you do not acquire the capacity for self-love in some exceptional mystical moment, well, that's okay, because it's always available to you as a reflex back to you from the way that you behold the earth. The earth will give it to you in every breath that you take, and does give it to you. And so again, there are the two cases of self-love, you might say, just like there are the two cases of, you know, unconditional love, the simple case and the informed case. And the simple case of self-love is the birthright of every single human animal living on this planet. No matter how shameful the conditions are born into, or how wretched, or how rich and privileged, all of it is irrelevant compared to the reflex that comes to you from the earth when you behold the earth in the gratitude that it naturally inspires in you. And if it doesn't inspire that gratitude, you're lost, you're over, you're finished, it's over for you. It's over for all of those people, no matter what is their status on this planet, high or low or anything in between. You cannot feel the gratitude for being on this earth, the planet that sustains your every breath and even gives you self-love so that you can continue to bear your mortal existence. Self-love can come to you, yes, as it has come to me in the Rhonda moment and other moments, in a spectacular surge of some mystical realization and some emotion of an oceanic power beyond what a human animal can bear. And it comes to you in the simple act of beholding the earth, but only as a reflex of your gratitude toward the earth. You know, I acquired self-love walking around the coves and ledges and estuaries of Friendship, Maine. And as a young boy already of 6 or 7 years old, even younger, when I would take the pass through the woods from the town down to the rocky ledges of Hatchet Cove and look out at the islands in the distance in Muscungus Bay. And I knew then, in the way that the child knows, without needing to have words, and in the total conviction of my feeling as a child, that I was so lucky to be alive, and that my life was right in front of me, that the source of my life was right there, as if a woman was standing in front of me, holding out her open hands and passing it to me from her hands. That's how every human animal acquires self-love. Accept it with gratitude, and self-love comes with it. And now, as the Calico War Party forms, and as the moment to confront duplicity in all of its facets on this planet is upon us, well, now is the moment to reflect on how essential that is. You know, It's not the truth of exposing the fraud of duplicity and deceit that is going to change the world. It is the countermanding truth that is independent of that exposure. The countermanding truth is an independent, autonomous force. Now, I am grateful, hugely grateful, for all those brave human animals so far who have dedicated themselves to exposing deceit and fraud and duplicity in our world. I couldn't have done that exposing. I couldn't have done what Judy Wood has done in examining what happened at 9/11 and what happened to those towers, how they became dematerialized. I couldn't have the time to put together a documentary like Evidence of Revision, which exposes the fraud and the duplicity in the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy. So I am hugely grateful for those people who have done the work of exposure, and there are numbers of them that lost their lives doing it. They were killed for that exposure. They went down on the firing line. And some of them, even before they could get out what they knew, they went down, like Mary Pinchot Meyer, or like Dorothy Kilgallen, or like the DC madam who was found hanged in her garage. You see, there are so many examples. So many names, and you ought to know these names of some of these people. You ought to say them aloud and thank them, because what they have done by putting their lives on the line to expose has prepared the battle line for striking against duplicity. And the moment of strike is coming. The year of strike is 2014. And strike happens in correction and not before. It does not happen during the conditions of reset, but immediately after. This is a strategic fact. And anyone who does not understand that fact and does not accept it cannot be engaged with the strike force. The strike force that comes through the Calico War Party in correction is really unlike anything that has ever happened on this planet before. It is a once in a kalpa event. Certainly once in this kalpa, and possibly this is the only kalpa in which this event has ever come to maturity with the full participation of the human species in the way it does now, right now. I'd like to make an observation for you all to consider. Now, I'll state this observation as clearly and concisely as I can. You know, of course, I speak, as usual, in a completely unrehearsed manner. So here goes. You can observe a syndrome in the human animal of a defeated expectation. And that syndrome occurs in moments of social revolution, in moments when, let's say, there is genuinely, realistically, an opportunity for change, and I mean massive change,
in the way that human animals behave in the social order. There are convulsions and eruptions in the social order that occur periodically in the course of this experiment. And right now, the entire human race is living in one of those convulsions. But you can observe that there is a kind of moral fallout in the throes of the convulsion. How would I describe this? Well, you see it all the time. You see it if you look at the mainstream news. Even there, you can see it. Over the last 3 years of reset, there have been various occurrences that reflect an escalating revolt against the social conditions on this planet, right? Obviously. But when you look at that revolt, when you look at the reaction of human animals to what they themselves have created in the social order, to what they have allowed to happen, you find a syndrome of defeated expectations. In the first place, protests and demands for a better way of life never really lead to any change for the better. The reason for that ought to be clear by now, especially at this moment, as I'm speaking to you in the shift of Matangi. Now, people can protest, and people can protest against unfair conditions. They can protest against the fraud in the banking system. They can protest against Monsanto, against chemtrails, against silent weapons for a quiet war, which is the use of microwave weapons to destroy human animals en masse in body and mind. You can protest against all of these horrors. Pick one every day. There's a smorgasbord of horrors readily available for you to taste and sample and consume. But look what happens with the two typical reactions to these horrors. One, to protest, social protest, and the other, to expose the nature of the social evils that are ruining this experiment and making it impossible for people in society simply to live and coexist with each other, not to mention mutual aid. We don't even get to mutual aid. We don't even get to try it out. We don't even get to find out if we are really indeed disposed to mutual aid as an animal species. There is so much deceit and so much manipulation coming at us every single day. And these two tendencies of reaction in the human animal, who still carries a certain sense of decency and truth, these two reactions are protest against the social evil and expose the agenda of social evil and the authors of that agenda, as well as those who execute it, those who execute the agenda, the accessories, the proxies, and so forth. That is the natural and massive reaction in the social order to the evils that the human animal has allowed to occur. But you'll find, and I think you can see it and measure the truth of what I say by the flow of current events. You can see that people in the social order lose their motivation and their morale. It falls away into disappointment. It falls away into disillusionment. Because, in fact, those two acts alone, protest and exposure, don't change anything. And one of the hardest lessons that I myself have learned over the last few years, I don't know if you put yourself in the same category with me in this respect, but I think that some of you will, is that the predators themselves, the perpetrators of social evil, don't mind protests, and they don't even mind exposure. In fact, they have a technique in which they expose themselves. They tell the public exactly what they're going to do by way of massive acts of deceit and orchestrations of fraud like 9/11 and Sandy Hook. And they utilize what is called the revelation of the method, which is a way to terrorize the general masses of the human population by telling them right out front and by showing them in one manner or another exactly what they're going to do to them. That behavior of the revelation of the method, is common to murderous psychotics and serial killers. Did you know that? If you go look at such classic films as Seven and Copycat, two classic American thrillers about serial killers, you will find that the perpetrators in those films relish and delight in the revelation of the method to their victims, as well as to the detectives and people who are trying to hunt them down. And this is exactly the same behavior that occurs with those perpetrators of social evil on this planet, whether they be the Zads with their agenda of racial supremacy and domination of all the nations that are not Zad, that are not of their chosen tribe, or whether it be all the accessories and proxies that go along with that horrific agenda of righteousness. And so, what I've observed, and this is a bitter, bitter lesson, is that the perpetrators actually can build upon protest and exposure of what they do to further and foster what they do. It's time to wake up to the reality of this dynamic. And so something has been missing. And in correction, what is missing becomes obvious. It may also become obvious that the time for protest and exposure is now over. I'm not saying that the entirety in its depth and complexity of the social evils perpetrated on this planet has been exposed. It certainly hasn't. But enough has been exposed. It's enough already. I designate April 1st, okay? April Fool's Day, 2014, as the day when the Anthropos celebrates the absolute foolishness of its own mentation and its own self-defeating expectations and gets over them and gets on with the offense toward the perpetrators and the psychopaths who have been allowed to run the social game on this planet. The social and economic game, the government game, these are aspects of the social contract in which all human animals are implicated, aren't they? And so who's to blame for the fact that the entire planet is run by gangsters and criminals and criminally insane psychopaths? Who's to blame for that? There aren't that many of them, you know. They're a minute percentage of the total population, but they have been allowed to do what they do due to the foolishness of the Anthropos. The Anthropos is an extremely foolish animal. And I might add, the Anthropos is, or to be a bit more kind about it, can be quite a nasty animal, too. Quite a nasty animal. You know, you must not think, my friends, that just because the Anthropos is in some manner the exceptional subject of this experiment, which is true, and just because we might allow ourselves to think that the Anthropos is the darling of Sophia's experiment because she and Telete dreamed the genome of our species with a very special intention of seeing how it would experimentally unfold in various favorable planetary settings. You know, it's tempting, if you love the Sophianic narrative of the mysteries, and you place yourself in there as the Anthropos. You know, you claim to be the Anthropos, do you? It's a claim, you know. No one is the Anthropos who doesn't claim to be. It's an existential stance. And given all that, it might be easy to overlook the fact, well, let me not call it a fact. Let me just put it in this way. I have yet to meet a human being who is as beautiful as a snow leopard. I have yet to meet a human animal who is as beautiful as a cobra or a June beetle or a monarch butterfly. So just because the Anthropos, including you and me, may be in some respect really the darling of this experiment, doesn't mean that we are not a nasty and foolish species, because we certainly are. And it wouldn't be possible, it wouldn't have been possible, for that minute faction of the human population to take over and control the rest in the way they do, if that were not the case. So, April Fool's Day 2014 could also be considered Humility Day for the Anthropos. And yet, there is no one, not even myself, who can estimate what can happen in correction. And we're not there yet, my friends. I'm looking at the calendar right here. I'm speaking to you now, a little later than the day I began this talk. Speaking to you on the 15th, Saturday. So I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks and 4 days. No one can anticipate the full scope of what is possible in correction. True. But the full power of correction through human participation in what the Aeon Sophia wishes in her reset of this experiment 200 or so years before that reset would ordinarily occur in aeonic timing. Human participation in what she wishes as the outcome depends on every single human animal who is in correction coming to realize what is the countermanding truth. Now, there are many ways that the countermanding truth can manifest. It can manifest in the small scale. It can manifest in the intimate details of your life, in your immediate social scene, your community, your neighborhood. It can manifest in the larger scale of the country in which you live, in relation to the government of that country, in relation to the evil of the state, which is totally a creation of the Anthropos. The Aeon Sophia does not dream what the state is. She does not have in the syntax of her dreaming the concept of any social order such as the state. That is entirely a fabrication of the human species. And she leaves the Anthropos as the main subject of this experiment in some respects. She leaves it completely free and unhampered to fabricate whatever it likes. And so it is within that fabrication of the social order, of the state, and of the many aspects of human bonding and the social contract, all the way from the family level up to the planetary level, it is in that vast field of human endeavors that you, each one of you, and myself confronts duplicity. And when you confront duplicity now, 4 weeks and 4 days from now, it cannot be like it was before. Because if you do not bring a countermanding truth that stands independently of the truth of what you're exposing, then you cannot be effective in correction. And this is a very high standard of human efficacy that I am attempting to put into syntax here today. And as I come around, I see this is 1 hour and 8 minutes. As I come around to the conclusion of this talk, well, I may as well return to the subject of unconditional love. And I may as well remind you and remind myself that there is also something called unconditional self-love. And that is what it takes to change the world. That and the truth that is synergetic with that unconditional self-love for your own life, that is what changes the world. It is not love for the world or for even any person or any cause or principle. No, no. Those who might have convinced themselves so far that they are leading some kind of revolution, that they are going to be effective
if they think that applying love to the world and to others can be a force for that change that they wish, then they are entirely wrong, and I am here to correct that error. And I can tell you that it's not all you need is love. That's the wrong syntax. All you need is self-love. And with that self-love, the sense for the truth of your life that is absolutely invincible, and it will outlive you. You can feel that it will outlive you while you are still alive, just like I do. You get my drift? You can feel how it will outlive you, and that is the conviction that goes into the strike against duplicity and the strike against the trickster, which is a supernatural factor of mind control that uses the psychopaths and perpetrators on this planet in a game of blind and pointless destruction. Remember the example of the Zads. I told you that they cut a deal with the Archons. And it wasn't just John Lash that told you that, was it? Because John found it in the Gnostic writings, and you can go there and find it yourself if you look carefully. He didn't make it up. So the Archons chose for themselves an agent. They chose an agent for themselves, Abraham, representing the patriarchal / salvationist belief systems, which have destroyed the human capacity to be moral. They have destroyed the moral force of the human animal. And there is a supernatural factor, and it is a compound factor of Mephisto and Yeldabaoth, the human-made and the extra-human factors combine into a terrible synergy that is bent on nothing but senseless and pointless destruction. And how are you going to stand up to that? There is only one way that you can do it, whether it be on a daily scale, within the conditions of your own limited personal life, or whether you stand up to it on a planetary scale. The condition is that you find the force to strike against duplicity in self-love. And you find that self-love as a reflex that comes to you when you feel gratitude to the planetary animal mother who gives you life and who sustains you in her dreaming. We are all nothing but characters in her dreaming. Do you see that now? And do you see the power of that imaginative proposition? That's the power to be released in correction. And you, each and every one of you, like myself, wields that power. When you hold a challenge in your eyes, the challenge to find what is, in any moment, in any situation, the countermanding truth that you embody. It can be realized, it can come to be realized in different versions, in different expressions. But whatever they may be, all those expressions have the same origin and ground. And that ground is your love
for the truth of your life, that it be as strong as your love for life itself.